Good morning.
Good morning, Sensei.
It's wonderful to see so many people back. I'm going to start out with a few words by Hakuin, who is a famous Zen teacher. Before I get started with the talk itself, just a few words on Hakuin. Hakuin was alive the late 17th and the early 18th century, and he lived in a monastery, and at some point he believed that the monastery really wasn't the place to continue practice, that you need to get out of the monastery and go live your daily life in with other people. This is very similar to Bernie Glassman, the 100-foot pole where we climb the pole, get to the top, and we're enlightened, but it doesn't stop there. And one of the ways that this koan is expressed is that you have to step off the pole and go back into everyday life. So this was Hakuin's way of seeing his Zen practice and his students as well. And he's also known for the famous koan, "What is the sound of one hand clapping?" So that's just a little bit about Hakuin. Now, according to Hakuin, there are three essentials for the practice of Zazen. And those essentials are great faith, great doubt, and great courage. Now, it's not often that we hear the word faith connected with Zen practice. But I think it's a very important aspect, a quality that we need to have to do this practice. And that's what I'm going to be talking a little bit about this morning. Now, great doubt is not knowing. It's when we give up all the stuff that the mind has created. And great courage is to do that, which can be as scary as hell. To let go of our grip on everything that we think we know, everything we think defines who we are. Now, the third quality that I mention is great faith. And I came across this while I was, this week thinking of what to talk about. And how many people are familiar with Elizabeth Strout, the author? This is her second book about a character named Olive, and it's called Olive Again. And there's something in here which was very touching to me, and it applied to what I'm going to talk a little bit about. So bear with me, and just notice how beautifully written this is. So the backdrop to this is Olive's father has died in a house fire, and she's with Bernie, and she's an attorney, and she's with a man named Bernie, who is also an attorney, and he's helping her get her affairs together. And they both avoided the Holocaust. And that's sort of the backdrop to this. Now, well, it's okay. The name here is Suzanne. But Suzanne said, Bernie, do you realize what I came from? Do you realize that? Oh my God, those people, how did I get out alive? And then Suzanne said, but you did too. You got out as well. She added, except your parents were murdered, and mine, well, they are almost murderers. My brother is a murderer. Oh, my God. And Bernie said, but you got out just as you said. And Susan asked, well, how did you get out? And there was a pause. Where were you born? Hungry. Bernie spread his hand over his face briefly. He wanted to commend her for everything that she had done with her life, to say that she had lived decently, helping those children every day through the Attorney General's office, and by raising her boys, and by her loyalty to Doyle. But instead, he answered her question. I got out when I was a kid, because my uncle came to America, and my parents wanted me to come with him. They said they would join us soon, and then they didn't. I didn't know you were born in Hungary. Do you remember your parents at all? And Bernie glanced around his office before he answered her. It had been a long time since he had spoken of these things to anyone. Well, I remember my father reading the Torah. I remember my mother setting the table. And I remember her reading to me when I was sick one time and in bed. Oh, Bernie, Suzanne's voice sounded stronger now. Bernie, can I just ask you one last thing? Of course, Suzanne. Do you have any faith? Religious faith, I mean. Bernie felt a physical response to this, as though a small wave had just rolled through his chest. He waited and then said, "Yes, you know, I have lived for many years as a secular Jew, and I don't believe I have any faith in that sense." "But," Suzanne asked, "there's a but. I can hear it in your voice." A tentative earnestness spread through Bernie now. He felt as though he had been called upon to give something of himself that was far outside his purview as a lawyer, and was something he had never given to anyone except his wife, vaguely, years ago. "Okay," he said, "the but is this. But do I have faith? I do. The problem is, I can't describe it. But it's a faith of sorts. It is a faith." "Can you tell me? Oh, please tell me, Bernie." Bernie put his hand to the back of his neck. "I can't, Suzanne, because I don't have the words to describe it. It's more an understanding, and I've had it most of my life. And there is something much larger than we are." He felt a sense of failure. He had failed in telling this. Suzanne said, "I used to feel that. For years I would have the sensations of just what you described, but I can't really describe it either." Bernie did not answer, and Suzanne continued, "When I was a kid and alone, I spent a lot of time alone, you know, when I wasn't at school. I would take these walks, and I would get this feeling, this very deep sensation, and I understood the only way a kid could understand these things, that it had something to do with God. But I don't mean God like some father figure. I don't even know what I mean." "I know what you mean," Bernie said. "And I kept having the feeling every so often right into my adult life. I never told anybody, because what was there to tell?" "I understand completely," Bernie said. "But I haven't had it for a few years, and so I wonder, did I make it up? But I know I didn't, Bernie. I never told my husband. I never told anybody. But whenever someone says they're an atheist, I always privately have this bad reaction, and they give all the obvious reasons, you know, kids get cancer, earthquakes kill people, all that kind of stuff. But when I hear them, I think, but you are barking up the wrong tree," she added. But I couldn't say what was the right tree for me to bark up. Sitting at his desk, Bernie felt a vague sense of disbelief. Everything she was trying to say was entirely understandable to him. Then Suzanne asked, "I don't know why. I don't get that feeling, that sensation anymore." Bernie looked out over the river. It had changed, as it always did. It was now a greener color, as the cloud covering went higher up into the sky. "You will," he said. Suzanne said, "You know what, Bernie? I've thought about this a lot. And here is the phrase that I come up with, what this means for myself. But this is the phrase that goes through my head. I think our job, maybe even our duty, is to," her voice became calm and adult-like, "to bear the burden of the mystery with as much grace as we can." Bernie was silent for a long time, and he said finally, "Thank you, Suzanne." You could say that this was the heart of living for them, even though they couldn't really express it, it was in their heart, this pull, this intuitive pull. Now, ordinarily, we think of having faith as something or someone external to ourselves, like they mentioned, a god, a higher power, a guru, a teacher. And in Zen, we are asked to have faith in ourselves, in our own intrinsic or true nature. We are asked to have faith that if we practice diligently, we will realize this true nature. But this faith is really undescribable. It's more of an experience, something that we're just drawn to do. Now, Zen Master Thang Stan said, "The great way is not difficult if you don't make distinctions. Throw away likes and dislikes, and everything will be perfectly clear." Throw away likes and dislikes, and you will be coming to practice in a very different way, an intuitive way. Master Zhang's words are true enough. We also know that practice can be difficult. For example, there are times when practice feels like we are banging our head against the wall, times when our teacher may not meet our expectations. Sometimes we compare our practice with someone else's, and tell ourselves we have come up short. Sometimes we cling to our preferences, and when our preferences aren't realized, we become disappointed or frustrated. Sometimes, without realizing it, we have created a goal, and when we don't achieve it, we get angry, pressed, discouraged, or self-castigating. So when all these things happen, we go through these kinds of experiences, why don't we quit? I would say, because on some nonverbal level, we have faith in this practice. So it's important at these moments that I mentioned to keep faith in ourselves and the practice. It's not an accident, right? It's not an accident that we are sitting here together this morning. It's not an accident that each of us has chosen to enter the way. My sense of that is that we are all responding to a voice deep within ourselves, which is calling ourselves. Now, a scientist might say we are being driven by our DNA. A priest might call it the voice of God. Whatever the source, we must listen and pay attention to this voice. It will sustain us no matter what difficulties may present themselves. We must have faith in this voice. For those of you who don't understand what's going on, I'm a big fan of Mary Oliver, and there was a time until somebody duct taped me, I think. I stopped reading Mary Oliver. But really, to get back in the place where this talk is, back in regarding this voice, this intuitive pull that somehow goes undescribed. Mary Oliver wrote a poem called The Turtle, which I have read before, but which I think really captures the spirit of what I'm talking about. The turtle breaks from the blue-black skin of the water, dragging her shell with its mossy scutes across the shallows and through the rushes and over the mud flaps, to the uprise, to the yellow sand, to dig with her ungainly feet a nest and hunker there, spewing her white eggs down into the darkness. And you think of her patience, her fortitude, her determination to complete what she was born to do. And then you realize a greater thing. She doesn't consider what she was born to do. She's only filled with an old blind wish. She's filled with an old blind wish. It isn't even hers, but it came to her in the rain and the soft wind, which is a gate through which her life keeps walking. She can't see herself apart from the rest of the world, or the world from what she must do every spring, crawling up the high hill, luminous under the sand that has packed against her skin. She doesn't dream. She knows. She knows that she is part of a pond that she lives in. The tall trees are her children. The birds that swim above her are tied to her by an unbreakable spring. So in order to sustain this practice, in order to keep moving forward and going deeper, we really have to have faith in ourselves, which I think each one of us in our own way has, but we have to trust it, even though it can't be captured and put into words or held in a box. Just trust that intuition, that old blind wish. That's our true nature calling us.